You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jō toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā, kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharāpere Thursday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by producer Sanat. Whai Akane come up in the show for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party. I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cepoloni on the spike in homelessness in Auckland, yesterday's nurses' strike and the end to same-day voter enrolment. For International Desk, I spoke to Justin Sobian, Senior Tutor in Law at the University of Auckland and Counsel for Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines on the recent International Court of Justice ruling on states' climate change obligations. Sanat, what do you have for us today?
For City Counselling this week, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about reports earlier this week of Auckland Council staff taking tents and sleeping bags from rough sleepers in the CBD, and more broadly, what Auckland Council's response to homelessness looks like. I also spoke to Associate Dean Pacific of the University of Auckland, Sir Colin Tukuitonga, about the growing drug crisis in the Pacific.
Here are Hofakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tukapatu Himai, text it on 5395, or Waia Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware, e a hei ana koto, te whakarongo ki ene korero ano, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, mea haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cepoloni.
According to outreach providers, Auckland has had a 90% increase in homelessness since September last year. Auckland Council's Community Committee Chair, Angela Dalton, says government policy changes have made it harder for people to access emergency housing. The committee has called for the government to work with frontline agencies to address the issue. Yesterday, nearly 36,000 nurses, midwives and healthcare workers went on strike for 24 hours. This follows the breakdown of mediation talks between the Nurses Union and Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand. The union says they are striking because of the dire staffing situation. And the government has announced a series of electoral law changes, including the end to same-day voter enrolment. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cepoloni about all of these issues. I started by asking about the increase in homelessness in Tamaki Makaurau.
What do you think has caused the increase in homelessness in Auckland?
I think it's basically that this government have not responded to the cost of living challenges that are in front of them, as well as that they have changed the criteria around emergency accommodation so that fewer people can get access to it, whilst pausing the public housing build. And so we've got a whole lot of New Zealanders who not only can't get an emergency solution to their homelessness issues, but also there's no long-term prospects on housing.
What do you think can be done to address the homelessness crisis?
I think the government need to be honest with themselves, listen to the frontline social services that are telling them that their emergency housing policy is sending more people into homelessness, and actually revisit the guidelines that they've got in place. But alongside that, they need to ramp up, as we did, the state housing build. Too many of the developments that were planned have now been put on hold. There's a whole lot of stagnant projects across the country. We're not getting state housing on at pace anymore, and the government need to do that quickly because there's so many New Zealanders that need that support.
Associate Housing Minister Tamapōtaka says it's not just the government, but a large part of society that's responsible for solving the issue. Do you agree with this assessment?
He's just trying to shift the blame here. The social services have been really clear. It's the government's policies that have sent more people into homelessness over the last couple of years. And so Tama needs to take responsibility for what he has responsibility for. And that's a portion of the housing portfolio. Him and Chris Bishop need to get moving because, you know, this is not the country that we want to live in. We don't want to be seeing people living in tents, living on the streets. We also don't want to see people or hear about people living in an unsafe overcrowded housing conditions because they can't get access to the housing that they need.
Moving to our next topic about yesterday's nurses' strikes, do you agree with the Health Minister Simeon Brown's criticisms of these strikes?
Look, I think that was so offensive, and we certainly heard that on the picket line in Auckland yesterday, where I was alongside my colleague Priyanka Radhakrishnan. They talked in their speeches about the fact the government is saying that they're disappointed the nurses are striking. But actually, the only ones that should be disappointed are the nurses, because they haven't been supported by this government. The main call yesterday was safe staffing levels. They have been put under so much stress. It's causing issues for them, and therefore potentially causing issues for all of us that may need to access the care that we need to. And so actually Simeon needs to take responsibility here and stop trying to shift the blame to the nurses. I've heard pretty horrendous stories from the nurses about what has happened as a result of the understaffing, and the government yet still continue to say that there's no hiring freeze. Well, every nurse you spoke to on the picket line, and there were thousands yesterday, would tell you they're experiencing hiring freezes under this government. And that's as part of their underinvestment in health and their prioritisation of things like tax breaks for landlords, tax breaks for the tobacco industry, tax cuts that they were told were unaffordable, over actually investing in our health system.
Are you concerned about what nurses are saying in terms of understaffing and underinvestment in hospitals?
Yeah, I am. And it's not just from the picket line. I had nurses from Waitakere Hospital come and see me a couple of months ago, and they were highly stressed as a result of the understaffing. They were saying that, you know, when there are vacancies, they're not able to recruit, or the recruitment is delayed. They've been pushed to do multiple shifts, sometimes double shifts in a row, to cover for the fact that there aren't enough staff to actually do the next shift. And they're saying it's pushing them to the brink. They were actually really emotional about what they were experiencing. As well as that, they were talking about the number of nurses that are going overseas because the pay and conditions are better for them. And in that small group that came to see me, of about six or seven nurses, there was one sitting there who was an experienced senior nurse who was actually moving as well as a result of all the stress that he's been facing here in New Zealand as a nurse.
We've also seen a change to same-day enrolments. What is your response to the government ending same-day enrolments?
I think it's appalling. And, you know, the feedback in terms of what it means for the Bill of Rights, the Human Rights Commissioner has come out against it. It seems so self-serving. I mean, why in a democracy would you make a move that would effectively see thousands of people cut out from having their say in who is elected as government? And that's basically what is happening here. And who are these people? Well, actually, the people that are less likely to be enrolled in time are our people on the lowest incomes, our young people, Māori and Pacific, and those from ethnic communities. David Seymour wants to call them dropkicks, but actually he's completely out of touch with the realities that so many people face. And sometimes they don't necessarily have the bandwidth to get on top of, you know, bureaucratic and government administration. And so perhaps they are a little bit late, but hey, we want their voices to be heard in selecting and deciding who's going to govern this country. But this government have decided they are not worth it, and, you know, for self-serving reasons, perhaps, they've made the decision that they're going to cut them out.
Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith says the changes is because the workload to verify late enrolments is too much for the Electoral Commission. What is your response to this?
Oh, that's just rubbish. And, you know, there's still going to be a high level of administration trying to work through who is enrolled, who isn't enrolled, whether their vote counts or doesn't count. After the election, and perhaps just pose more confusion for people and the actual system. So, you know, Paul is just trying to create an excuse for the decision that he's making. But effectively, you know, I think it's fair to say that many of those that are more likely to not be enrolled within that set period are not necessarily national voters. And so, you know, I'm going to take the cynical view here. They're doing it for self-serving purposes.
And are you likely to reverse these changes if Labor wins the next election?
Oh, we will always, always push for policy that ensures the biggest majority of New Zealanders are able to get out and vote and be part of the democracy in whatever way that means.
That was Labour Party Deputy Leader Carmel Cepelloni on the spike in homelessness in Auckland, yesterday's nurses' strike, and the end to same-day voter enrolment.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
On Monday, Auckland Council staff were cited taking belongings such as tents and sleeping bags from rough sleepers at the Grafton United Cricket Club ground. This is happening at a time where the amount of rough sleepers on Auckland streets has increased 90% since last September, and 15% of those leaving emergency housing are going straight to homelessness. On Tuesday, Auckland Council's Community Committee received updates on the state of homelessness in the city and discussed what the council's response will be. For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about the worsening homelessness in the city. I started by asking about the incident on Monday and whether Auckland Council is doing enough to respond to homelessness.
Earlier this week, there were reports of Auckland Council staff taking away rough sleepers' tents and sleeping bags in the CBD. I just wanted to get some insight into the specific instance and whether there has been any noise about it in council, and more broadly what Auckland Council is doing to respond to homelessness in the city.
Yeah, so it's so important that we're talking about this, so thank you for raising it. I do get frustrated because we spend a lot of time talking about helicopters and stadiums and stuff, and actually we spend very little on, you know, one of the biggest crises for our city, housing, and in particular homelessness, so thank you for raising it. The first thing to note with this particular incident is I don't have specific info on this, but I do know from past experience that the approach with people leaving their gear in public places is that there are some secure places provided throughout the city centre where those living on the street are able to leave their stuff securely, and that's arranged with council and council security and third parties and stuff like that. But there is a policy where if it is in other places and it's unattended, it will sometimes, if it's, you know, created some kind of problem in terms of it's in the way or something like that, it will sometimes get picked up and stored and people can claim it. So it's not disposed of or thrown out or anything. And council is looking at, yeah, we do have certain parts of the city centre where we haven't got a place yet. And it's kind of one of those things where you're sort of putting a band-aid on the bigger problem, but you probably still need to use the band-aid, if you know what I mean. So, yeah, so I think with this particular incident, that's what was happening, and I think there's comments from Adrian Wilson, who's the head of compliance. So we had a really big, we get a 6-monthly update to the Community Committee on Homelessness, and we just had that on Tuesday afternoon. We had the most recent one. And what's happened with homelessness over the last couple of years in the city centre in particular, but more broadly as well, is that we've actually shifted it from the regulatory committee, where it was very much sort of treated as, okay, how do we make sure people abide by the rules, to the community committee with the agreement of the regulatory chair and everything. Everybody sort of agreed that was the wrong approach to be taking from a governance level, looking at it for, you know, how can we make sure people follow the rules. We needed to be more of a compassionate approach, which is kind of what council was doing as much as possible anyway, but shifting it to the community committee, shifting that focus now means that that's, you know, very much how we're doing things officially. And so we had the 6-month update on Tuesday afternoon. Some really stark stats in there that, for example, show that we work with partners to get data about what's happening on the ground, but a lot of homelessness is really hard to count. We can count the people on the street, but it's really hard to count people who are living in cars or couch surfing, living in overcrowded conditions, that kind of stuff. But the estimates from partners are that the number of homeless that they're seeing on the streets has almost doubled in the last 6 months. And it's hard not to draw a connection there to the change in emergency housing policy from central government. And that's what the community agencies who work in the sector are telling us, is that, that they feel that that's the people that are no longer able to access emergency housing. That's one of the places that they're going. And central government have admitted that they don't know where about 15% of those people are going from their own work. So that's really worrying. Yeah.
So a lot of the delivery model for Auckland Council's work, especially over the last term, has been to find third-party providers that can work in partnership with council to deliver high-quality social services or social services at cost. Has this been effective when it comes to responding to homelessness? Have there been providers that have been able to step in, or is this still a big gap in the sort of services that council provides?
So we have actually been ramping that up. So we have half a million through the long-term plan every year, and we actually increased it. I think we put another, off the top of my head, 160,000 around that into it, and we recognise that the expertise to work with people who are in really complex situations often does often sit with community providers who are able to, someone turns up from council on a council logo high-vis vest, that's not necessarily going to create the kind of connection you need to be able to actually, really, in the first instance, have a good conversation with the person if they perceive you're coming from a position of authority and you're there to tell them off, which, is common a perception of council, not just from people who are homeless, then you're less likely to engage and share your needs and your vulnerability. So I think we've got really good relationships with a number of agencies. Kahui Te Kaha, for example, they're the only ones who are actually providing a 24/7 emergency accommodation referral service. And unfortunately, central government stepped back from funding them. So some of our extra money has actually stepped into the breach there to enable them to continue offering that service. So I think council probably has it about right in terms of the approach. Whether or not it's big enough, particularly in a situation where central government is withdrawing from this area, that I think is a genuine question. And a lot of the discussion on Tuesday was about, okay, how can we secure more resources for this work in the future? Because we know that this approach, where council kind of provides a backbone and coordination and a clearinghouse for all the stats that the different agencies are using and things like that, and then is able to provide advocacy to central government, but also between agencies so that they can make effective changes. We think that model is quite effective, but maybe it needs more resources behind it. One of the other things was we had a presentation on Tuesday from the City Missioner, and also particularly on women's homelessness, but also on what they're seeing in the food security space. And they talked about the impact of cost of living increases, the increase in the cost of housing, giving people far fewer choices. So, thinking about women in particular who might stay in an abusive relationship because they can't afford or find suitable housing. And that's another kind of form of homelessness that we don't necessarily count, because technically they're housed, but they're not housed safely. And if they had choices, then they would choose not to be living in that situation. And so how do we really get to grips with those kinds of challenges as well? And then the food security piece, that's the other big thing, that the cost has been increasing. So cost for people to be able to buy food for themselves, but also the cost for those who provide food, the food banks, the mission. Those people who do the community meals at our community halls and facilities once a week, the cost of doing all of that has increased dramatically. And so there's a real crunch on a lot of this work, unfortunately.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 on any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
To you, Samantha, take Coco's Cantina's Tuesday Mates Rate deal, pairing $6 Prosecco or Peroni with $17 pizzas as your deliciously wedded weekday partner.
I am! I do!
And do you also take the late night $9 happy hour, 9 till 10 on Fridays and Saturdays, as your weekend lover?
Oh my god, yes! A partner and a weekend lover? Oh, does this count as ethical non-monogamy?
Fill your boots and feel the love at Coco's Cantina, Tuesday to Saturday, 374 Karangahape Road.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse. Headway wins the Spring Cup.
Oh no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashdowns, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
BFM presents B-Sides, a shiny new web series featuring local artists performing two of their own songs and one Kiwi cover.
Hosted by legend Tuva O'Clifton, Season 1 features Phoebe Rings, Soft Bait, Emily Bateman, Jim Nothing, Babe Martin and Eliza.
B-Sides, new episode dropping every second Wednesday. Watch it now on the 95BFM YouTube channel.
95BFM presents The Others Way, Saturday, November 29. Where you can see Geneva AM live.
Tiri-tiri
This is Metal by The Beths, and before that we had a bit of Geneva AM with Toitū Te Tiriti. Welcome back to The Wire here on 95 BFM.
5, 4, 3, two, one.
International desk.
Our go.
The International Court of Justice has issued an advisory opinion that nations can be held legally accountable for greenhouse gas emissions. The court found that those who are harmed by human-caused climate change could be entitled to reparations. The case was spearheaded by Pacific Island students and the government of Vanuatu, and then backed by 105 sponsor countries. For International Desk, I spoke to Justin Sobian, a University of Auckland senior tutor in law, who also acted as counsel for Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Here is that interview.
Could you start by summarising the result of the ICJ ruling?
Yeah, sure. In summary, the ICJ ruling, because it's more than, I believe, how many pages? I mean, it's 150-odd pages. Essentially, what the ruling is saying is that states developed or developing, or which are vulnerable or not vulnerable, have obligations to protect their peoples or the earth from the devastating impacts of climate change. And this is present generations and also future generations, the generations that are not yet born. So it has, that's the general nutshell of it, if you want to put it that way, that states have obligations to protect the earth or the planet from the devastating impacts caused by climate change.
You were at The Hague when the ruling was delivered. What was it like to be there?
Well, it was like an out-of-body moment, to be honest. I mean, the thing is, nobody knew what the decision would be like. In fact, there were some, including myself, who felt that the ICJ is traditionally known as a very conservative judicial organ. So I was trying to be cautiously optimistic, but in fact, I was sitting down next to my Caribbean colleague of mine from St. Lucia, and it was just ticking all the boxes every time the president of the court was going through the paragraphs of his opinion, well, the judge's opinion, which was, of course, as we know, unanimous. And there was a lot of oohs and ahs and nudging with the elbows and so on. And he said, this is the point, this is what we're asking. So every single thing which I think, let's say 95% of the arguments which small island developing states, vulnerable states argued, was actually received and welcomed by the ICJ. So I think it's definitely a landmark and historic opinion, which will be cited for decades or even centuries to come, in my opinion.
You acted as counsel for Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. Do you think the ruling could make a difference for island nations which are particularly vulnerable to climate change?
I think it definitely can, but of course it's not going to happen overnight. The ruling is not going to stop the largest or biggest polluters from polluting. It's not going to, all the greenhouse gases currently locked in the atmosphere is not going to just disappear overnight. But I do think that in the long term, even in the medium term, countries such as Grenada, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and even as far the next side of the world where we are, the Pacific Island nations, we had a meeting already this morning, Alliance of Small Island States. There is implications in that we now realize that we could have a class action, possibly a class action against the biggest polluters for sea level rise, which are totally engulfing all of our countries, especially in the Pacific. If you look at Tuvalu, for example, Micronesia, another example. So I think there are implications, I think, in the long run, and states are already putting their heads together around this advisory opinion, trying to digest it to see how we can move forward in terms of litigation and also COP negotiations, but it's going to be something for another question. Yeah.
Does the ruling bring new responsibilities for New Zealand, particularly towards our Pacific neighbours?
Yes, I think definitely it does. I think when I was there, Joel, I think in December, and we listened to New Zealand's statement, and a New Zealand colleague, a Tuvalu colleague, came up to me and said, well, there's nothing there in the statement, honestly, that says anything about the Cook Islands or Tokelau or Niue. So I think especially for those small island states in the Pacific, which New Zealand has a specific, a special relationship with, well, Cook Islands, they get their separate statement for obvious reasons, but countries such as Niue and Tokelau, they didn't. So I think there is a sense of neglect. So I believe now that with the COP negotiations that are coming along, with more delegations coming and impressing upon themselves the need to observe this ICJ ruling, I think New Zealand has to be very cautious and has to act, I would think, in the best interest of these small island states, especially those which they have a special relationship with.
And what are the next steps now that the ruling has been delivered?
So the next step, that's what we're trying to do right now, put our heads together. The Pacific states, I know, are going to have a meeting sometime in September, I believe, under the Pacific Island Forum. I may be invited as a Caribbean member, small island state, being in New Zealand, as I have been in the past. So AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, has a Zoom meeting this morning, 9 o'clock New Zealand time, discussing about what are the next steps. I think the focus right now will be, well, the ZDSU in the COP negotiations, which, of course, is going to take place in Brazil November to see. But that is the closest nexus, this International Law Week happening in New York, September. But I think in terms of strategic negotiations, we're going to try to see how we could leverage the ICJ outcome into that. Because you'll recall that there were some delegations, I think 2 years ago at the COP, it was India and India and China. But anyway, there was a debate of whether you should phase out coal or phase down coal. Of course, we small island states were saying we should totally phase out. But then the actual term that was left in the agreement is that we should phase down. And now the ICJ is saying that fossil states who continue to support or subsidize fossil fuel production or fossil fuel subsidies, they may be potentially be liable for international wrongful act in terms of compliance with climate change. So that is something that's something huge, it's immense, that we can use to show that, listen, even the ICJ is saying that continuing to invest in fossil fuels could amount to a wrongful act under international law. One thing I would like to add is that there was a special mention, I think, of the present generation acting as trustees of humanity, meaning for the trustees of humanity or trustees for the earth, meaning that the present generation has an obligation to hand over the earth to the future generations, or the generation not born, in at least at the same level as they had it, at the very minimum, the same level. Of course, we could improve, but I think that was an argument that was raised by my delegation, Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and maybe I think Cook Island spoke about it as well. So we are very happy to see that that made it in the main judgment, that the present generation or states have to act as trustees of the environment, trustees of the earth for future generations. So I think that was a very important point to stress.
That was Justin Sobian, Senior Tutor in Law at the University of Auckland and Counsel for Grenada and St. Vincent and the Grenadines, on the recent International Court of Justice ruling on states' climate change obligations. We'll be right back.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
had a few songs there for you. That was, this current song is One Is Always Heading Somewhere by Womb. Before that was Mandarin Tree by Phoebe Rings. And we started off that little break there with Cruise Control, with Headless Chickens throwing it back a little bit there. Welcome back to The Wire.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Through a mixture of seasonal migration, deportations, and cost of living pressures, Pacific Island nations are facing an unprecedented influx of methamphetamine into their communities. I spoke to Sir Colin Tukuitonga, Associate Dean Pacific and Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland, about this crisis in health. He says that meth poses a dire health threat in the Pacific. It's extremely addictive, devastates people's mental health, and is driving the spread of HIV in Fiji at an alarming rate through needle and blood sharing. According to Sir Colin, more needs to be done by the international health organizations and law enforcement to help fund better rehabilitation services and stop the inflow of meth into Pacific Island nations. Here is that interview.
Can you briefly explain the nature and size of this methamphetamine crisis in the Pacific?
Well, thank you for the invitation. That's an excellent question. Therein lies the problem. Everyone has an opinion, but it's actually very difficult to get an accurate assessment of the nature and extent of the problem. We know it's big and we know it's growing, but that comes from odd pieces of information. Someone, a house is raided in Fiji, in Nandi, and they find meth in the house. Packets of drugs wash up somewhere on a boat. So all of these things give you an indication of the nature and the size of the problem in the islands. But my own view is that it's actually a complete conservative estimate of the size of the problem, and it is growing every year, largely as a reflection of deportations from the United States and Australia and to some extent New Zealand. An unstable world, increased use of methamphetamine in New Zealand, a combination of things. We have people from the island who are part of what's called the Recognised Seasonal Employer Scheme who come backwards and forwards. So lots of indications on the nature of the problem, but as I say, we don't actually have a good enough, reliable estimate of how big the problem is.
Can you then maybe talk about the extent of harm that you've observed as a part of this crisis?
Yes, and so the obvious ones, of course, that you hear about is arrests being made as a result of violence between people who, drug traffickers and people who buy and sell this stuff. What's less obvious is the social harm in these communities, particularly violence against women and girls and kids, petty crime of theft, people looking for money to buy the drugs. And so there's a combination of health harm. People who take methamphetamine, of course, you all know, will have serious effects on their health, personal health. But beyond that, there are clearly social harms, family harm, violence, and related problems like that.
So within that context, do you believe that Pacific governments are doing enough currently to respond to those harms?
Well, I guess they're doing the best they can. It's a big ocean, as you know, and it's being used to as a corridor to traffic drugs from South Central America and Southeast Asia to Australia and New Zealand. So it's a very big ocean, and it's very hard to police and monitor. The equivalent is the surveillance and monitoring that the various governments use to monitor illegal, unregulated fishing. It's a big ocean, and it's very difficult to monitor traffic. I should double back and say one of the problems I didn't overlook to mention is the resurgence in HIV/AIDS in Fiji has been completely attributed to drug use. It's not from the sexual transmission that we've known about. So it's wide-ranging. Pacific governments and regional organizations, including our own government, are doing their best, but it's a big job, a difficult one. The New Zealand Defense Force does surveillance, for example, for illegal fishing, but obviously it includes tracking and monitoring the trafficking of drugs.
There particular reasons why this crisis is worsening in the current moment?
The fundamental problem is socioeconomic, meaning people finding it hard to get by, and so, you know, cost of living, not just a problem in New Zealand, but it's a global problem. Employment opportunities are limited, incomes are declining. And so as a result of all of that disruption, people are clearly looking for alternative sources of income. So that's, I think, the main reason, coupled with the points that I've made earlier about people being deported from the United States and elsewhere and bringing their bad habits to the islands. The island communities are vulnerable communities. Poverty primarily and low incomes, and people are, of course, going to be taken advantage of by the traffickers.
Given all of this and the nature of the crisis at hand, what do you believe New Zealand's role is in responding to this or aiding a response to this, and more broadly, the international community at large?
For the New Zealand government, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that they are already doing work in this area, particularly through the chiefs of police. They meet regularly. These are police chiefs from around the region. The surveillance activities by the New Zealand Defence Force. I know that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade provide aid, financial and technical assistance to island governments in terms of monitoring the drug trade. And obviously, beyond New Zealand, the Australian government's important, and of course, the international efforts. I think part of the problem in the islands is there's no one single entity responsible for monitoring, surveillance, and reporting, and also to just acknowledge that drug enforcement. Limiting drug harm is a global problem, and I think it's difficult for everyone involved. It's particularly problematic in the islands with limited resources and a vast ocean to monitor.
That was Sir Colin Tukuitonga, Professor of Public Health at the University of Auckland, on the scale and harm of the meth crisis in the Pacific.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpiti Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Carmel Cepoloni, Councillor Julie Ferry, Grenada and St Vincent and the Grenadines Council, Justin Sobian, and the University of Auckland's Sir Colin Tukuitonga. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia. We'll be right back.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.